So without further ado, let's get started. Our host tonight is a regular, I'm sure that many of you are familiar with. What?
Oh, I was just saying the one, the oh, I was yes. like doing background.
Oh, thank you. That's just what
like
I need.
Drum roll. I was doing the whole.
You can hear his commentaries every day on Michigan Radio during Here and Now, as well as Wednesday and Saturday mornings during Morning Edition. It's Michigan Radio's political analyst, Jack Lessenberry.
Woo!
Thank you. My real name is Sarah Silverman. I'd like to thank all of you for coming tonight. I have two of my favorite former students, Carly Adams and Mikey Ferentz, are here. Then they don't even have to take tests anymore. They pass. So,
what is it really like to be a Jack Lessenberry student? Tough. Very tough.
Well, suffice it to say, only the ones that need extra credit are here. But nobody wants to hear about that. We have a wonderful group of panelists here. I'm going to start introducing them. On my far left, not necessarily politically, is Aaron Foley, who's one of the most talented young writers in Detroit. He has a book out called How to Live in Detroit Without Being a Jackass. I'm not in the index, but it's a wonderful book. He's now the editor of Black Magazine, Black Lifestyle Magazine in Detroit, and doing an impressive body of work. Next to me is Zoe Clark. All you need to know about Zoe Clark is that 10 years ago she was my intern, and now she's my boss. And now she's a program director at Michigan Radio, at least until they finish construction of the Zoe Clark building in downtown Ann Arbor. Next to me on my right, I'm an Ann Arbor communist, probably is on my right, is Brandon Dillon, who is the chair of the Michigan Democratic Party and former state representative from Grand Rapids. And his soulmate next to him on my far right is Stu Sandler, who I've always been impressed by. He has his own consulting firm. He works with Republican candidates. He's former aide to Mike Cox, am I correct? And he is a fellow that I've always regarded with a lot of intellectual integrity, even when we disagree. So I thought, we certainly want to get you folks involved. I thought I'm going to ask a couple of general questions of my fellow panelists to prove that it was worthwhile bringing me here. And then I want to open things up to you. I only ask you, when you'll raise your hand. I think we have someone to come around with a microphone. Please ask a question, don't make a speech, or I'll cut you off. Like all phony liberals, I can be a Nazi when I want to. So, anyway, I want to start.
And Jack hasn't even been drinking yet tonight,
and this is
him on fire.
But I have been to Toledo, and that has the same effect. I'm going to start with Stu, and I want all of you to respond to, what is the most bizarre or surprising thing you think out of this whole election cycle?
You only have to pick one.
Where to start? It's really hard to single it down to one thing. I mean, you know, this has just been, Brandon and I were talking beforehand.
Stu, will you hold your
microphone? You hold your microphone.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. You got it, Jack.
We only paid for one microphone.
Yeah. I mean.
Our next fun drive will.
I was going to say, where do you start with this election cycle? This has absolutely been the most bizarre election cycle. Oh, there we go.
It's microphones all over.
There we go. Microphones everywhere. I can't single it down to one thing. I mean, it just seems really, really bizarre to the point where I think the most bizarre thing, if I had to think about it, was the fact that you had a debate where both the candidates and their families couldn't shake hands. I think it says a lot about the civility and the level of discourse in the country. It really shocks me that we've sort of come to that level, even when we disagree and argue and run tough campaigns, that at the end of the day, people can't realize kind of what the issues are all about. So I think if I had to pick one moment, that would probably be it. But Brandon and I talked before, there's really never been a cycle like this. So, but if that's the one moment, I'd think.
Brandon? For me?
Yeah.
You know, I actually think that this has to do with not shaking hands, but it had to do with hands. I was down here for the Republican debate in Detroit at the Fox Theater as the to give the loyal opposition to do media, afterwards, and I was in the media room watching the debate with all the national media and local media, and it was at the point where Donald Trump started talking about the size of his hands at the debate, and the entire room just all the jaws dropped, mm-hmm. and everybody was like, we can't believe he just said that, and mm-hmm. didn't do any. It probably went up in the polls after that. So it's been a very crazy election, but that was the one moment I represent or remember that I was shaking my head and couldn't believe what we were just watching.
Oh, you want Aaron and I too. You know what? I would love to choose just one. I don't think that gives any of the opportunity, though, to really look at, for me, what comes next. So I think we've been covering it day to day, and it's been absolutely absurd. I'm not going to just pick one. What I think is craziest is just what's going to happen in 2018 and what's going to happen in 2020 now that we have reached this level of discourse. And again, the things that we've seen that have just kind of made our mouths just drop open, the things that have been said, how do we ever go back to quiet debates? How do we ever go back to civility? And that's the real question that I'll be having, and what I'm going to be surprised to watch. Maybe that's a cop-out answer, but it's the truth.
Am I on? Oh, okay, I'm on. So this is going to sound kind of weird, but I've never been more ashamed to be a man until this year, because I feel like we've been forced to talk about issues such as women's achievement, feminism, things like that, in such an ugly way that I've just been. We've been talking about, you know, feminism and you know, women climbing the corporate ladder and things like that for years now, but the vitriol and whatnot surrounded around Hillary Clinton's rise to where she is right now, and the way that we've been, you know, forcing people to talk about it that have been ignoring it for so long, and this begrudging debate that a lot of people are having, it sort of reached and not just achievement, but also, you know, all these subplots, such as accusations of sexual harassment when the second debate happened, and the four women who had previously accused Bill Clinton of such things, you know, were brought to the forefront, and it's just like, really, we have to discuss it in this context? You know, not to say that there's ever like a right context to discuss it, but all of these different things surrounding women, I guess. I'm sort of looking at myself in the mirror like, man, men are terrible sometimes. So that, you know, I think, you know, once all the dust is settled, we'll still be having some of these conversations, but to have it in this forum has definitely been interesting to me. So,
well, let me give my two cents worth, since I'm, you know, my primary perspective is that of someone who's old. Think of Gandalf without a beard. But seriously, what I think most startles me is sort of the breakdown of national consensus over what elections are about, what they should be about, what party structure is about. It is, to me, this is more the case of the Republicans and the Democrats. I'm not approaching this from an ideological standpoint. I'm approaching from the standpoint that a person like Donald Trump could be nominated by a major party and survive the sort of things that have happened. I thought I've been writing about politics since 1976, and when he survived blood coming out of her, whatever, I realized that we were in a very, very different place that we've ever been before in terms of politics. And my worry, beyond whoever wins or loses, is that we are losing any kind of national consensus of ourselves as a people. I can tell you, in 1976, there was a very close and hard-fought election between Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter, but the day after the election, the people on the losing side felt more like a Michigan fan would feel if they'd lost by Michigan State than you feel, you know, in your sort of Manichean universe, and the devil's triumphed. So those are the kind of things I'm sort of worried about. I'm going to ask the panel just one more question, then I want to turn it over to you. If you folks don't ask good questions, I want to remind you that I'm a combination of the worst of two possible professions, journalist and professor, and I can filibuster for hours on things I know nothing whatsoever about. Those of you who have heard me on the radio may know that. But I'm going to start again. You don't have to agree. I'm going to start again with Aaron. We'll go the reverse order. And if there's a surprise next Tuesday night, if we are surprised by something on election night, what do you think that'll be?
What do I think the surprise will be? Or what do I think will... Okay. I think the surprise will be... let's say that Donald Trump wins. Oh God, I'm gonna be that guy. let's say that he does win. Let's say that after everything in the past, this past cycle, he does win. What if the surprise is that he was doing all of this for attention, and then he kind of shapes up to be not a bad guy? I don't know. What if he was just like wearing a mask, and then like the Scooby-Doo gang says comes out and says, "Well, actually, he's a good Republican, not a bad one." I don't know. That would be my surprise, I guess.
I think a surprise for me would be following what the system of democracy has done for hundreds of years now, and that is the peaceful transition of power. I think if Hillary Clinton wins and by, you know, 11 o'clock, midnight, we hear Donald Trump come out and give a concession speech that is conciliatory and congratulating his opponent and saying kind words about the hope that the country comes back together and can work better together in the future, and that it has been a nasty campaign, but that he hopes folks who support him come out and at least give the benefit of the doubt so that we can have a peaceful transition. If I hear that speech from Donald Trump, if he loses, that would surprise me next Tuesday night, early Wednesday morning.
Mr. Dillon?
Well, I just want to remind Jack that Michigan did beat Michigan State this year. It was not the other way around in your
I
analogy.
Know,
so
I
just
know.
To make sure we're clear on that. You know, I
was saying a hypothetical.
Well, it's hard to know. I mean, there's only one of two options. One of them's going to win. So I don't know if there's going to be a surprise. I think
I don't mean just the presidency. I mean on any level.
Boy, I'd be lying to you if I thought I could predict what some of the surprises are. I was on the way up to the stage, and I was checking my Twitter feed because every 2 hours it seems like there's something.
Well, what's a plausible happens. Surprise? Something that could conceivably happen that would shock you a little bit.
I would be surprised if Democrats took the U.S. House back. I don't think that's likely right. to happen. I think they'll pick up some seats, but that would suggest that the polling was not necessarily at all accurate in reflecting what people think and would have a late break against Trump. But it'd be a pleasant surprise, right. but I don't know if it's going to happen.
Stu. Yeah.
I think the biggest surprise is going to be the results of the presidential. A good friend of mine, Saul News, has said in the Wall Street Journal today, he'd be surprised if Trump... He wouldn't be surprised if Trump won 40 states. He wouldn't be surprised if he lost 40 states. The volatility you're seeing in the presidential is just amazing. You know, ABC Tracker came out today. A week ago, Donald Trump was down 12 points. Today, he was up one. There's a real volatility. I can't tell you exactly how it's going to end up. I've seen massive movements in just about every race, every region of the state at the top of the ticket. And there's a lot of surprise places where Trump is doing well, where normally a Republican wouldn't do well. And there's places where a Republican strongholds where Trump is significantly underperforming.
So what does that tell us, though, then, about voters in 2016, that in such a quick time, less than 2 weeks, we can see something like a skew of 12 points? Or does it have to do with polling?
I think it has to do with the unfavorability of both presidential candidates. They both range anywhere from 55% to 65% unfavorable. And I think both candidates, voters are having a hard time in a lot of respects choosing between them.
But are voters really that fickle?
I think they are. You know, these were – I think what it comes down to is you have – there's a partisan base which has absolutely chosen who they're going to vote for, both on Democrats and Republicans. I will say one of the things that's underreported is the resiliency that Trump has had with Republican voters. In most of the polling I look at, Trump is absolutely – performing where you would think a Republican presidential candidate would, if not in some places exceeding it. Now, there are some parts of the state where he's underperforming, but in most parts, he's absolutely performing well with Republicans and well with independents in a lot of places. So I think what it has to do with, there's this middle that doesn't like either candidate, and they're ping-ponging back and forth.
And I'll tell you, this is not really a surprise, but this is the thing that's going to most fascinate me. If Hillary Clinton wins, and Nate Silver, the great guru of prognostication, says that there's still a 72% chance that she does, if she wins, what becomes of the Republican Party? Now, the Democratic Party, for whatever you think about Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, has sort of come together and sort of acted like a Democratic Party, which, of course, is just a coalition of groups that hate each other but hate the Republicans more. Republicans, if you – and I'll bet you if Stu was honest and I said a year ago, Stu, you're going to nominate a candidate that every living Republican president and every living former Republican presidential nominee is going to repudiate, how are you going to do? He would now be in the bomb shelter with Eva Braun. But and yet, as he said, they're running even in the polls. But if Trump loses, my question is going to be, are Republicans going to repudiate him? Are they going to blame the media? Are they going to think they need to become more moderate, more conservative? I don't think anyone can answer those questions. The only prediction I'll make is they won't call them that. But if Trump loses his election next round, you're going to have superdelegates. You may not call them superdelegates, but you're going to have superdelegates to try to prevent this from happening again. So anyway, I want the audience to ask questions. So can somebody raise their hand? And where is Vanna White? There she is. Could you say your name and what you do?
My name is Nicole Bishop. I am a UAW pipe fitter.
Right.
20-plus years for Ford Motor Company. Mother of three. Single mother of three. Your obvious disdain for Trump, and some of you have made it obvious, is there anything that you agree with in his platform? I found that watching the debates, I am a diehard Democrat, I'm voting for Hillary. But I have actually listened to debates open-mindedly, and I agree with him on a lot of economic decisions or things that he say he will do once becoming president, whereas I don't agree with Hillary.
Well, that's a good, interesting question. So follow up on that and tell me then, why are you voting for her?
Moral standpoint, ethics. I mean, disregarding these emails, and I think that's a lot of rhetoric.
And real briefly, where do you have the greatest agreement with Trump?
Social justice.
Social justice.
And I don't believe that he really has the best interest in mind for the common person.
But I'm saying, where do you agree with him?
I think if you make $1 million and more, he's your buddy. He's going to take care of you. I think anybody that is just an average middle-class person, he's not going to take care of us. He says he will, but I've seen past that. I've listened to what he says he wants to do with this, and we've said it.
I think you misunderstood me. I didn't say it well. What is the thing you agree with him on? What is it that you like about what he says?
Oh, gosh. Our trade agreements with other countries, okay. I think we need to be a lot tougher on that. I think we, as a nation, our continent is so big and we have such a huge population that we can afford to be independent of other countries and have our own economy. We're in a global economy now, and that is not doing us any good. Okay. It is bringing the other countries up and bringing us down. Simple as that. And I really think we need to be tougher on that.
Okay, well, that helps us define. Thank you so much.
Can I jump in?
Yeah, I'm going to ask, who wants to respond to that?
Well, I think there's a lot of things that Donald Trump has said that has really tried to appeal to that anxiety that a lot of Republicans have had, frankly, rank-and-file Republicans who have disagreed with the party leadership on issues of trade and taxation and the minimum wage. There's been a real disconnect between where the elites are and where the base is. And Donald Trump has really exposed that there is a core group of Republicans who do not agree with the philosophy that's been espoused since Reagan, where it's cut taxes very much for the wealthy and have these trade agreements where, we're not protecting American workers. So I think that's one of the issues that's going to be really played out afterwards this election, is where does the Republican Party go in terms of, do they gravitate more towards where Donald Trump has taken them, which is more, I guess wouldn't be to the right or to the left, but more towards folks in the middle class and working class voters, or do they continue to have a party platform and policies that really are for free trade and loose taxation policies? I think it's anyone's guess at this point.
Well, if I could jump in, sure. One of the interesting things I think Nicole brings up is how much Trump has transformed the debate, particularly on economic policy. Prior to Trump entering, the Trans-Pacific Partnership was pretty much on fast track. And when he started his opposition to it, you just saw piece by piece people walk away from it to the point where I'm not sure that you could find an elected official who's on the ballot this year who supports it anymore, which is it's an amazing transformation that's happened over a year, and it just shows the power he's had over the national dialogue.
I think that was a brilliant question, if I can jump in. And I think there's the key to this. I think that you're absolutely right. I don't necessarily agree with you about the issues, but Trump realized, and he was the first person to articulate, that NAFTA really hasn't been good for a lot of workers in this part of the world. And also, I think that Hillary Clinton's biggest weakness in this campaign is failing to understand, or at least to articulate, how generally, I think the scientific word is pissed off, the American voters are in general. And Trump, as Bernie Sanders before him, has managed to tap into that. So I think that may be one of the reasons that you have some sort of, you have people on both sides that might not have been there before.
Yeah, and Nicole, you are the reason why that right now the Trump campaign is hoping or thinking that Michigan, for the first time in six election cycles, could actually vote a Republican for president. I don't think that's actually going to happen. But as we all know, the sort of infamous Reagan Democrats who came from Macomb County, I mean, the idea that if Trump is going to win this electoral map in 2016, he's got to change the map. And what that means is industrial states, what we like to call, you know, Rust Belt states, and including Pennsylvania and Michigan, states that have typically gone Democratic in the past, recent history, but turning over to Republicans because labor is frustrated, because middle class workers are frustrated. And I think that indication right now that you are starting to listen, particularly about economic issues, is very indicative of what the Trump campaign sees and why they are making a play in Michigan, even though, you know, right now, again, as I said, recent history shows that Democrats are in favor to win, that it would go blue.
Yeah, we did a story in our current issue that's out, not to, you know, put some cheap plugs out there, but where Trump is polling strongest, like Zoe just said, Macomb County, definitely. But also the Downriver area. Mm-hmm. And those two areas of Metro Detroit especially have two things in common. One, there is a lot of labor, a lot of auto workers, but not just auto workers, just labor period, you know. And military, the Selfridge Air Base in Macomb County for one. But there's a lot of either veterans or active military in both of those areas, and they both have the one thing in common where they are thinking, like, what is going to happen to me? If we expand free trade, if we, keep moving jobs overseas, that's the tagline that really hits a lot of people right, not just in their hearts, but also in their wallet too. So, there is a very strong chance that people are going to ignore a lot of the other issues that have been brought to the table, both socially and politically, and just kind of go with, you know, where their paycheck is, pretty much. You know, am I going to have a job after this election, or should I go with a candidate that can help me protect my job in spite of everything else? So that's why you are starting. And there are ripple effects. I remember talking with a friend on Facebook. I live on the east side of Detroit, and even though I'm a super pro Detroiter, I do some of my grocery shopping in the Grosse Pointe. Sorry. So and all along, the narrative has been Trump is polling highest among working class white Americans, but most of us know Grosse Pointe is not home to a lot of working class white Americans. It's a lot of wealth in Grosse Pointe, but you do see a lot of Trump signs in the Grosse Pointe. Why do you see that? Because there are ripple effects as far as, you know, it's just not the labor that may be affected, but it's the white collar automotive workers that, you know, you go higher up the chain that may also be affected. So there's ripple effects across different communities that we're seeing, and, you know, it's, like I say, it could be a surprise.
On the other hand, of course, if you look at college-educated, professional, white women in Oakland County, women who normally vote Republican, Trump is, you know, in the toilet there. Next question. This gentleman right here.
Thank you. My name is Matthew Bodie. I'm a pastor here in Detroit,
Matthew.
About 15 years. And one of the things that I think we're going to have to wrestle with as a country is, what does it say that to get the nomination of one of our major political parties, that the easiest way, or maybe one of the easiest ways to get the nomination, is to be openly xenophobic, openly racist, openly Islamophobic, openly sexist, openly misogynistic, and that's what can get you the nomination of one of our major parties. And I think that's something that this country really has to wrestle with, that the stuff that we have had swept under the rug is out there in the open. And if we miss this opportunity to confront it...
Is there a question in there?
Yeah, respond to that.
So you're a Trump supporter, obviously, then. Stu, do you want to...
Well, you know, the one thing I want to pick up is, you know, and this gets back to, I think, the previous question. You know, Aaron brought up two areas where Trump is performing well. The one area he didn't bring up has the same characteristics, Traverse City and the Upper Peninsula. Retired UAW workers, a lot of veterans up there. But, you know, one of the most interesting analysis I've heard about Trump was, of all places, Michael Moore. I don't know if you've seen it, but he has a video out where he basically calls him the human Molotov cocktail. And he warns Democrats, saying, you're not picking up the despair that middle-class voters have, the desperation they have, and to the point where Moore predicts Trump will win Michigan, which would, you know, if Trump wins Michigan, as most people recognize in terms of the presidential map, Trump will win the presidency. So it's just, you know, I think there's an undercurrent which he's tapping, which I think it's the responsibility of both parties to figure out, what is the desperation these people see and how do you provide them hope?
Well, I think it's interesting if you look at what happened to the Republicans after the 2012 election. The RNC initiated an autopsy, and the results of that autopsy were that the Republican Party had to change. It had to appeal more to Latino voters, women, millennials, not be so avowedly anti-LGBT. And Trump basically came in, took that autopsy, ripped it up, and threw it away. And I think you're seeing the kind of consternation that's really caused with, as Jack said, all the former Republican presidents not endorsing Trump, people like John Kasich and others, and even, you know, folks who have, you know, had to kind of go back and forth on their support of Trump, because I think they realize the share of that vote is declining. If you look back over the last few presidential cycles, I was just looking at something in North Carolina, for instance, the white vote as a share of the overall vote. There's a reason North Carolina is competitive now, because the share of the white vote in that state is about 20% lower than it was in 1988. And you're seeing the electorate being comprised more of African-Americans, Latinos, immigrants, and others. And the Republican Party, frankly, will, no matter what happens in this election, if it continues down this road, will lose elections at the national level for a long time to come. And even the most creative redistricting efforts will not be able to stop the long-term demographic changes in the country.
I want to inject myself in here for a minute and remind all my panelists that there's more on the ballot than the presidency. And I'd like them to, I'd like them all to briefly respond to me, one of the most important and maybe overlooked things on this ballot is a regional transit authority, which would propose that would revolutionize transit in this entire area, including Washtenaw County, have special lanes for fast buses to whisk everybody to the airport. It would effectively merge, where there'd be smoother transitions between SMART and DDOT. I want everybody to tell me whether they think this is going to pass, starting with Mr. Foley.
While I personally hope that it would pass, I think it's going to be a very tough sell for a lot of people. One, the toughest sell for anyone, whether you live in the city or suburbs or in the country or in the city or whatever, is the fact that this is all going to take, what, 30 years to finally come to fruition, and that's a very large commitment to ask from a voter. That's also a very
It's a 20-year bond 20. Issue. Yeah. It doesn't mean it's not going to happen for 20 years. It's tax. We increase our taxes for...
Folks who would actually be using the system, it would be 20 or 21 before you're actually getting on a bus and feeling a huge difference.
20 years or in 2020?
2020. Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, I think what is it? The first thing we're going to see, like, immediately is the commuter bus, if it passes, the commuter bus from anywhere, or maybe not anywhere in Metro Detroit, but certain spots in Metro Detroit to the airport, and that's great. But that would probably help still, like, relatively speaking, a very small part of the population. There's still a lot of people who, frankly, may not be able to use public transit in 20 years, but are still wondering, like, why do I still have to pay for this? You're asking Detroiters who have been taxed for a lot of different things and have been under-delivered in the past to also fund something that may not come to them in another 20 years or so. I think those are the biggest hurdles that people have to face. It's going to affect people, especially in Wayne County, where the property taxes, you know, have had to go up in order to make up for lack of services, be it in the city or some of the suburbs and things like that. So asking people to pay more for something that may come, there has to be some very strong guarantees that I think people aren't sold on yet. And I also personally think that the RTA, you know, the lobbying has not really expressed the benefits clearly to people. There is a very long plan and a very big website that, you know, is certainly available to the public, and that if you're a wonk, you know, you can take like the 2 or 3 hours.
But they haven't made the sale to the
average person. Like, you know, we're still dealing with, like, how I forget what the percentage is, but it's either 60 or 40% of people in Detroit don't have internet. So who's going to go to RTA.org and read through this whole plan? So I think selling people, just the point of selling people on why this is a good thing, I think that's something that the RTA has lost in this process. But it's going to be a tough sell.
Interesting. I want to go back. I want to skip around. Stu, you're a Republican, but a lot of top Republicans have endorsed this. A lot of business interests are in favor of this. What do you think will happen?
Well, you know, I just want to say firsthand that you're right. The presidential race has kind of swallowed up most of the conversation, and I've kind of had tunnel vision beyond that on my own campaigns. But the little I've watched this, I think this is a much smarter campaign that's being run than the one that was being won for Proposal 1 in last year of the May 15 one that went down 80-20.
It's hard to get worse than that.
That one had this bizarre, if you get in your car, you're going to get hit by a rock and die, which no voter bought. This, the ads have been actually smart and calculated, and it talks about it in a way where it shows some measurable benefits to people. You know, the one thing is, though, normally what happens in a situation like this, when there's little information and a voter walks into the booth and they see a price tag on the ballot language, and I got to be honest, I haven't even seen what the ballot language is for this, their normal inclination is to say nope and move on. Particularly,
It's like a first date. If you're not sure, you say no.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And that's – you're so right. No, but – you know,
I never get a second one. Actually.
if I had to guess just based on it, I would say it won't pass. But there's been a good amount of advertising, and I think it's actually good advertising. But I would say the voters probably, you're right, they haven't made the sale. And I'm guessing that a lot will just kind of check the box no and move on.
Brandon.
Yeah, I really don't. I'm not even going to offer much of an opinion because I don't know. I hope it does. I think it's good for the long-term economic prosperity of the region. I come from Grand Rapids, where we have one of the best medium-sized city regional transit systems, and it has produced strong economic benefits. So I hope it does, but I'd be lying to you if I said I had any idea if it will or not.
I think it will, but I wouldn't be surprised if it won't. I don't think it'll pass Macomb County, but I think if, you know, I don't know how effective. I think the TV advertising is effective. But I don't know how many people it's reached. It'll certainly win Washtenaw and Wayne and probably Oakland, but we'll just have to see. question from the audience. This gentleman right back here in the blue shirt, fashionable blue shirt here. Oops, I'm sorry.
Hi.
I meant, you go first and then the gentleman behind. That's okay.
All right. I'm Dave Harden from Royal Oak. I'm a retired teacher. And I've read that we haven't been this polarized since the mid-1850s, and we all know what happened shortly after that. Do you see any parallels between those, you know, this pre-Civil War time and now?
Well, let me start by
Jack remembers it well.
I think the difference is that besides neither of the candidates having a beard, the difference is that polarization was largely sectional. It was, you know, it was very clearly sectional, North against South. We don't have that here. We have sort of, you might say, I don't know if class against class is correct, but there are definitely sort of two Americas who don't talk to each other anymore. And I think that's a problem, but it's not about to lead to a civil war. What I'm worried about is that it's going to lead to, it is leading to less feeling of ourselves as Americans. And I was at a party in Bloomfield Hills with a bunch of liberals, and this woman said to me, I've never even met anyone who's for Donald Trump. Well, you know, obviously she needs to get out more, and we saw people. And on the other hand, when President Obama was reelected, I saw a story, all these people, evangelical Christians, saying, he's the Antichrist. We never met anyone who could vote for him. Why is that the case? So I think there is division. I don't think there's a threat of another civil war, but Zoe, you're our expert on wars.
Well, I think the change is the way that we're communicating with each other. I mean, so I will throw my age here. I was not alive in the 1850s. So I'm 32, and I can remember ever since being little always hearing that this election was the most important election everyone's lifetime and that we have never seen anything more divisive than this election. Now, 2016, will I add that things have changed and does seem incredible and odd and chaotic? Absolutely. I'm not sure that I would agree, though, that things are ever more partisan. And of course, it goes back from the, you know, famous, you know, eighth grade civics class we all took, right? That there was a duel over, you know, someone died over it, that someone was beat with a cane on the House floor, the Senate floor in the Capitol. These are things we're not seeing today. I think the real issue, though, is the way we communicate and the way that we get our news and our information, and that facts necessarily aren't facts anymore. And maybe I'm thinking too much of this from a media standpoint. But in 2016, if you want to better understand a story, you go to the website or the television cable news that you believe is going to give you the facts, and those tend to be partisan today. And as Jack is saying, you also tend to live with folks who agree with your viewpoints. Do I think partisan politics is any worse? Not necessarily, but I think the way we all get our information and see the world is changing, has become much more insular, and that you read the blogs and you listen to the folks that you agree with. And again, some of this has to do with the media, that there aren't two or three voices right now that we all as Americans tune to. And when someone says, you know, the Vietnam War is not working anymore and we need to end it, that America goes, oh, wow, here's the voice that we all agree with. And that's just not what we have right now in 2016. That's what I think is changing.
And that's the way it is.
Can I interject real quickly?
Yes, of course.
So if we bring this down to a local level, this sort of answers your question, Dave, and also Matthew, your question about how we're sort of talking to each other. I think if you're a person of color, you probably heard racist things at some point in your life. If you're a woman, you probably heard sexist things in your life, and so on and so forth. So when it comes to having a candidate that is so brazenly sexist or racist or any type of ist, for some of us it's kind of old news because we've heard it before. But the thing that sort of fascinates me is how here in Metro Detroit, how a lot of how our demographics are changing across different cities. You know, when I was a kid, I probably grew up around 99% black people, but it seems like I grew up in the city of Detroit. But read any headline nowadays, the trend is always black people are leaving Detroit, white people are coming back into Detroit. But where are black people in Detroit going? They're going literally every other suburb that was predominantly white when I was a kid. So And not just that, you're seeing lots of Latino populations moving beyond Southwest Detroit and Mexican Town now. So it's and of course Arab Americans. You know, it's not. Of course, Dearborn is the stronghold, but you're seeing Arab American populations all over Metro Detroit. So you've got all these different populations now living together. I think the question we have to face is how do we talk to each other after the election? Because even though we may be divided among certain lines right now, we're still going to have to live with each other after next Tuesday. So what does that mean for, you know, social interaction? What does that mean for online interaction? What does that mean for, you know, these daily things that we have to deal with that we probably didn't have to deal with as much 20, 30, 40 years ago, but we certainly have to deal with them now.
Stu,
if we choose
do you
to
think?
Do with it.
Sure. You know, look, politics is a hard-fought sport, and people get very emotionally vested. People work really hard. People devote their lives to it in some cases. And, you know, I had a candidate who lost a primary who was very kind of, you know, a little shell-shocked when it happened. And
I'd say bitter.
Well, maybe. But I would tell you, when I was talking to them, you know, I said, okay, it's time to concede. And they kind of said, well, you know, I'm not sure I'm there yet. And I basically said, look, you play organized sports? And they told me the sport. And I said, you shake hands at the end of the game, and you move on. And that's what you're going to have to do. I have a pretty and that's what they did. I have a pretty optimistic view of what's going to happen after this election, in sense. I know there's a lot of rhetoric out there, but I think the loser, whatever party it is going to accept it. I think the parties and the followers are going to accept it, you know, members of the party. I think there's going to be whoever party wins. You're right. In 2008 and 2012, I was part of some of those conversations. How do we change? What do we do? You know, and you have sort of the same people saying, we got to go this way, we got to go that way. But I have a pretty optimistic view that people are going to accept the results, move on, and then fight for their beliefs and causes at another time. You know, Zoe was right. She picked out a couple of, you know, civics lessons we've all know, the Aaron Burr Hamilton deal. You know, there have been messy parts of our democracy. But now the language is a little coarser. It's a little more omnipresent. But I think there's going to be less of a sort of catastrophe and drama than has been given. Just my opinion.
Well, I certainly hope that Stu is correct, but I'm not all that optimistic. I remember my congressman is Sandy Levin, who is a very good congressman, even though he's 321 years old. And I had breakfast with him in January. If you're young, you probably don't remember. He lost two very close races for governor in the 1970s. And I said, was that the worst thing that happened in your career? He said, well, yes, except for the fact that I lost those elections to one of the most decent and fair human beings ever in politics. Can you imagine somebody saying that today? And I think that especially Donald Trump's behavior of saying that he might not accept the result is certainly beyond the pale of anything we've seen before. So I hope that was all rhetoric. I hope Stu is absolutely right. But there's been a disturbing tendency of candidates who don't concede. Jeffrey Feiger never conceded defeat to John Engler when he lost, and there have been some Republicans too. I hope that they do play by more or less the Marcus of Queensbury rules. Brandon, you want to weigh in?
I'm not going to add much other than, you know, I don't think there'll be a civil war. But I do think there's some other disturbing trends beneath just the presidential. You have certain Republican Senate candidates saying that they don't see any reason to fill a Supreme Court vacancy. And the Republicans in the Senate have held open this Supreme Court vacancy. So those things that were kind of always just assumed would happen, there'd be a fight, but the president gets the opportunity to do those things. I think those are going to be the test of which of whether or not Stu's optimistic vision for the future is actually a reality.
Another question. This gentleman back here, he was first. Wait for the microphone.
Yeah, Eric Anderson. I was going to talk about rapid transit, but I'm not going to miss my chance, so I'm going to talk about this. It was mentioned that you check with the library or you do this or that, and I want to know how you feel about the fact that there's so much misinformation and lack of trust that truth or facts seem irrelevant. How do we deal with that?
Who wants to take a crack at that?
Well, you listen to Michigan radio, obviously. Right. 888-258.
Jack, can I?
Sure.
Well, it's funny. I also, you know, I do a lot of reading of just headlines as I'm traveling around. But somebody put up a post that said, you know, this there's going to have to be a therapy course for fact checkers after this after this election for PTSD. I mean, it is enormous. There, I think it's the Toronto, is it the Globe and Mail, has put out a running series every day. I know it's a Canadian newspaper, but all the untrue things that Donald Trump has said every day. And a normal day, it's like 15 to 20. On a better day, you know, for him, it's, well, for, I guess, more, you know, it's 30 to 40. I mean, it's the fact that so many untruths and things that are dubious in terms of facts are put out there is making it even harder to determine what is true and what isn't.
I think the problem, I think that's a very good question, and this is what maybe worries me more than anything else. We used to have, as Zoe alluded, these national gurus like Walter Cronkite and Huntley and Brinkley. And even if you look at Watergate, Watergate was like a morality play where Nixon was accused of these things. He denied it. Information surfaced that proved that, yes, he was guilty and he was lying. And he quit. And everybody sort of accepted that. Now, I mean, I don't know what intellectual furniture is in anybody's heads. I don't know where they get their information from. Everybody on this panel, and I dare say everybody in this audience, probably is far more informed
yes.
than the average person. And I don't fault necessarily people. Let's say you're 38 years old and you've got two jobs and your spouse has two jobs. And when you're not at your jobs, you're whisking your 2.3 children to soccer and dance recital. And these kids are more scheduled than some of these candidates. When do you have time to do more than hear a snippet on whatever news you listen to? And I think that's something I don't know how to overcome that. That's what the people in Michigan Radio, we try to do. But not everybody, unfortunately, listens to us, and not that we give a complete full picture of everything either. You've got to work. It's easier to get information than ever, but mm-hmm. it is harder to get a concise digest of relatively, objective is the wrong word, relatively neutral news, and that scares me.
Absolutely.
Somebody else.
On that happy note.
There's a lady at the bar there.
Hi. Hi, my name's Ruth. I'm an analyst here in Detroit.
Hi, Ruth.
Hi.
What kind of analyst? Psycho?
Data. Numbers. Ah. Yeah. How can we make it easier for the people of Michigan to vote? Mm. Not just this election cycle, but in the future as well.
Yeah. Brandon, you wanna take that? Oh, sorry, right in the middle of
food.
A huge bite.
Well, I think, look, Michigan has some of the most restrictive voting laws in the country. There's, I think, even the Detroit News is now editorializing for early voting and no reason absentee voting. There's a number of states. Look around the country. Every time you put on the news, they're talking about all the people voting in Ohio and Arizona and Florida. And these aren't necessarily liberal states. These are just states that have made the decision that it's better for the administration of elections to make voting easier. It's one of the things we've been struggling with as Democrats in Michigan. You know, we feel there's been a concerted effort by not just Republican legislature, but the Attorney General and others to make voting harder. So hopefully there'll be a building consensus, and I think Republicans' fears of this are really unfounded. There's really no good reason not to let people do early voting, no reason absentee voting, make registration easier. You know, people should be able to make their case, and hopefully we'll start to see some changes. But there are a number of states who are doing a number of things that we could just emulate.
Stu, why don't you respond to that?
Yeah, I guess I have a lot more faith in the American people than I think a lot of people. I think they can find information if they want to, and I think most of the time voters do sort of develop their own sense of what's right and what's wrong. And I think, you know, people, you know, it's not that hard to vote. I think you look across the world at some of the countries where it's really difficult to vote. It's pretty easy in Michigan to vote. So you can say what you want, but I think it's pretty easy to vote here, and I think it's pretty easy to get information here.
Try being a working person on election day with 1 hour off and a long line. The precinct.
I run my own business.
Can I throw
Aaron?
In one more
yes.
thing? It's easy to vote if you live in the city that you vote in and your address is also in that city. But if you own a car and you live in the city of Detroit and your address is not in Detroit, because your car insurance rate is so high in the city versus any other city. Where are you going to vote? Are you going to drive back to your hometown and vote for a candidate or two that you weren't paying attention to because you were here in Detroit paying attention to things like the CBA and everything else? Or are you just not going to vote at all? Or are you going to continue to reside in a city where you legally can't vote? I wholeheartedly believe that until we fix our car insurance situation here in Michigan, we're still going to see a lot of non-voter trends here. So,
Zoe?
Well, I mean, I think we come across it in two different ways, that Republicans are very concerned about ballot security, that is where they come from. And you've had past Republican secretaries of state say that we are concerned about the security of ballots and voter fraud. Numbers have shown that maybe those concerns aren't actually accurate when you look at the numbers. And Democrats come with the idea of more folks voting is better. And this comes to the fact that right now, for the past 6 years, we've had a majority in Lansing of Republicans, right? We've got the executive office. We've got both chambers of the legislature Republicans. And right now, there is no reason that we're going to see any changes as Republicans run the tables in Lansing, and no reason that they particularly would want to make that
And now
change.
I'll give you the real answer to the question. You're asking, what can we do to have a fair system of voting? We need to adopt the system that they have in Oregon and Washington and Colorado and increasingly in California. In Oregon on Election Day, there are no polling places because the government has sent everybody a ballot in the mail. And this does a number of things. A, it saves Oregon $3 million a year. It would save us more. Turnout is 80%+, not 52% or 55%. But another thing happens in those elections. Republicans don't win races in Oregon anymore or in Washington, and they're dead set against it. They don't care about ballot security. That's all a canard. That's not true. There's no reason to worry about ballot security. Somebody did an analysis of 1 billion votes cast in every election since 2000, found 34 fraudulent votes out of 1 billion. No, they don't want a whole lot. Make it easier to vote. And I think, apart from partisan considerations, it is the only way you can cast an informed vote. I have to disagree with my colleague Aaron. I do this stuff for a living. Because I'm old, I automatically get an absentee ballot. It's delivered with my cream of wheat. I look at this, and I don't know the people running for my community college board of trustees. I don't know some of the candidates for probate judge. What I do is I call people up who I respect and say, who should I vote for? The normal voter either A, skips those races, or B, votes for everybody named Kelly, except in Macomb County when they vote for somebody named Viviano Szymanski. But so, you need to have time with your ballot. That would be the best way for people to vote.
Because I'm young, I take an Uber to my polling place.
Next question. Let's see, there's a lady right here.
My name is Jan, and I'm retired. If Trump were to win, what do you predict for foreign policy?
Stu, you're closer to him.
I think he's been pretty. I think he's been pretty upfront with how he would manage foreign policy. It's a pretty wide view of the world. Is there a region that you're interested in, or is it just in general? I was at a panel discussion with James Woolsey and Dennis Ross over the weekend, and they said, regardless of who wins, what would be advice you would give to the president? And both worked in both Republican and Democratic administrations, and they both said, make sure the United States reminds who its friends are and doesn't reward its enemies as much as it's doing. And I think it's good advice to take to heart, and I think the Trump administration would follow that.
Brandon?
Well, I am a little less, I think nobody knows except there'll probably be a lot of excursions to Moscow and other places that he seems to have friends in. But, this is a guy who has Bobby Knight, the former coach at Indiana and Ohio State, introduce him at a rally and says, the best thing about Donald Trump is he won't be afraid to drop the bomb. And that's scary. That is not the kind of person that you want the temperament to be doing foreign policy, regardless of disputes that I've had and Democrats have had with Republican presidents, probably going back as far as there's always been a sense that there's a level of seriousness. And even with George Bush, who people kind of made fun of, he was surrounded by people who were, you know, we maybe disagreed with the decisions, but had some foreign policy experience and had a worldview based on some sort of intellectual capacity. Donald Trump's just, you know, whoever compliments him that day, you know, if the mullah's in Iran, say, hey, your hair looks good, Donald. Oh, we're going to change our foreign policy. I mean, this is what he says. So I think we should probably believe it.
Anybody else? Any other thoughts? Well, I'll only add that, you know, I have the utmost respect for our first questioner, Nicole. But, Nicole, you're wrong. Protectionism, we can't be a economy unto ourselves. And we need, whether, I'm not saying that you are totally wrong about trade deals, you're not. But we can't, every economist will tell you that a protectionist, totally protectionist policy would be an economic disaster for us. And that's what I worry about.
But doesn't this come back to the idea, though, that anger among Americans is trumping, no pun intended, some of these larger issues, that the anger about the economy and feeling like there is some other, whether that other is a minority or an immigrant taking a job, that there is some amount of anger out there. And no matter what Trump can say, whether it's bigoted or not, folks will say, well, Trump will be Trump, but I believe he is standing up for my economic principles and my concerns. And Stu, I wonder what your thoughts are when we're talking about foreign policy. Do you think that there are some folks who just vote, as we know, it's the economy stupid, and don't quite care even about these foreign policy ideas, or don't quite care about the things that he says?
Well, I think you have both. I think you have voters who vote with jobs as sort of their primary mindset, and they vote in who's going to improve my lot in life better. You know, I worked a year for the Republican Jewish Coalition, and I went around the country meeting people who were sort of their primary focus was foreign policy. And I think there are those out there. I think there are those who think the U.S. standing in the world is diminished and that they don't necessarily agree with the direction the Obama administration's taken. And I think a lot of them are sort of gravitating towards Trump.
Another question. Let's see. This gentleman right here.
Hi, I'm Brian. I'm a marketing communications representative for an ID company in Farmington. And I have a question that's similar to the retired teacher from Royal Oak. It has to do with polarization of Congress, though. I wrote it down, so I'm going to read it. I remember reading a Washington Post article from last year that discussed the polarization of Congress from 1949 to 2011. There was an infographic in that article that displayed the increasing polarization of Congress. So my question is, you know, if Democrats are a unified group that stand against Trump, and then you start to see highly respected and influential Republican leaders disavowing Trump and moving away from them, do you think that maybe both parties will finally unify if Trump is president?
Well, let's ask our distinguished Republican leader on the panel to start. Stu.
You know, I'm going to say this, and I don't know if it's going to be popular, but I'll say it anyway. You talk to Democrats on the Hill, you talk to Republicans on the Hill, and right now one thing they'll tell you is one person who's not fostering relationships with congressmen on congresspeople on both sides of the aisle is Barack Obama. He's had some of the worst relationships with congressional leaders from both parties in a degree that they haven't seen. And you could kind of make disparaging remarks about George W. Bush, you can make it about Bill Clinton, you can make it about George H.W. Bush, Ronald Reagan, go back and forth. But I think if you talk to people who've been around Washington, D.C., they'll tell you that that Barack Obama just really didn't put the time and energy into building relationships with leaders from both sides of the aisle. And it affected how Congress did business. Now, yes, there's sort of hyper-partisanship on both sides, and that's definitely affected policy moving forward. But one of the things that really affected it was the fact that Barack Obama didn't put the time and energy into building these relationships. So when he needed to call on it, he didn't talk to people in Congress.
Let's give Brandon a chance to respond.
So I'm not going to get, you know, obviously I would probably take a different view. But I think the bigger question is why can't Congress get anything done? Why the increasing polarization and no ability to work towards some kind of sensible compromise on issues? You saw it with the Affordable Care Act. I mean, despite the fact that there were probably 6 to 8 moderate Republicans in the Senate that under different circumstances would have voted for it, they all didn't. And the big reason, especially in the House, is the way districts are drawn. I mean, there is absolutely no incentive, frankly. And this, you know, you can have good people go to Congress, but if their entire reelection is in a primary, which is increasingly controlled by, on the Republican side, for instance, people who are whiter, older, and more conservative than the general election, and on the Democratic side, more liberal, you're going to get people who make decisions based on what's best for the primary election. No matter how smart they are or how compassionate they are, they're going to do what's in their self-interest. So the only way, you know, one of the first big steps we could do is redistrict reform around the country where you have districts that are geared towards having competitiveness in the middle, where Democrats and Republicans aren't worried about their primary race as much as their general election and have to deal with issues that appeal to people
in the middle. You think you get more moderate Republicans and more moderate Democrats?
I think it would be in their self-interest. The system, the framers set up a very good system that was trying to temper and reward people's ambition. They didn't think people were angels. They understood that they had ambition, and the system was set up so that, especially in the House, you had 2-year terms. You couldn't get too far away from where your electorate was. But again, if you have no incentive for a general election and it's all primary, your decisions are going to be towards your base.
Let me ask Stu a slightly different question. Is the Snyder administration over? If the Democrats capture... Some people, the Democrats have some chance of capturing the state House of Representatives. What would that do to politics in Lansing if they did?
You know, it's an interesting question. I don't believe the Democrats will win majority in the state House.
What if they do?
If they do, I think Rick Snyder is perfectly situated to deal with a Democratic state House. I mean, the one thing about Snyder, I didn't support him in the primary. He came outside of politics. And doesn't have the normal mindset, and frankly, it frustrates a lot of Republicans sometimes because he doesn't have the normal partisan mindset when he approaches problems and he approaches policy. He is a very pragmatic person that really just approaches things and says, I want to solve a problem. How do I solve it? And I think if you ask some of the Democrat leadership in Lansing, they'll tell you that he's taken the time to kind of talk to them, work with them, and in some respects... Well, deal with them in some ways. And I think Rick Snyder would work with a Democratic administration almost as easily as he works with a Republican
exactly.
administration.
What about the idea that if the House went Democratic, and Brandon, what do you think about this, that Snyder may actually be a little happy, that he probably would be able to get at least some of the things that he wanted to get done, and that really it's been the House Republicans who have been, you know, a thorn in his side, not since day one, but for years, that we've seen agreements between a Republican Senate and Snyder and the mayor of Detroit, for example, about a lot of different issues, and House Republicans have come in and said no.
Well, you know, I certainly hope very much that we have a Democratic majority, and, you know, I think there's a very good chance that it'll happen. I think the biggest the one person who's going to determine whether the Snyder administration is finished is Bill Schuette, who has a who suffers from no lack of political calculus. And we'll see what he does over the next year and a half to probably make his life miserable with an eye towards a general election, frankly, in 2018. I think Bill Schuette has positioned himself for the primary by never backing away from Trump, and he'll try to position himself for a general election if he gets through the primary by going after Rick Snyder.
Brandon, do you agree with the proposition that it's going to be harder for Democrats in 2018 if Hillary Clinton is elected?
I think it could be. I think recent history has shown we have a tougher time turning out our voters. I don't necessarily know what's going to happen. It's going to depend. I mean, if you said, do I think so? Probably. It'll be a tougher year for Democrats in 18. But, you know, who knows what happens with Congress? Do they shut down the government? I mean, there's a lot of unknowns, but I would say, yeah, it's definitely a tougher – off years are tougher for us, especially when we hold the presidency.
Which is always true, that whatever party is in power, the first midterm particularly, or even the midterm and the second term, tends to be devastating. But, Stu, talking about Rick Snyder again, He has not been on the campaign trail for many House Republicans. He has put money in. He's going to campaign for Jack Bergman up in the first. That's a congressional district, though. Why aren't we seeing Governor Snyder campaign for House Republicans?
Well, I think he's been. I've seen him campaign quite a bit. In fact, he was just yesterday he was in Plymouth with Jeff Noble in the House District 20. One of the things is, you know, thinking about how Snyder came into politics, politics isn't his first passion. He's a policy wonk. He's an accountant. He looks at numbers. He looks at number sheets. He wants to solve problems. So he's not someone, he's not Barack Obama who gets juiced up to go on the campaign trail. His first love is policy, and his first love is problem solving.
If Governor Snyder had a 75% positive favorability rating right now, he would be on the trail much more than he is.
I honestly say Rick Snyder is campaigning as much as he's campaigned in the past when he's been off the ballot. And I've seen him quite a bit across the state.
Probably not in Genesee County. Aaron Foley.
I was going to say there's a big elephant in the room we haven't addressed. I was going to ask, like, okay, is the Snyder administration over or is Snyder himself over?
Well, answer it.
I mean, it's tough to tell. I mean, I think Snyder himself might be over, but, you know, could Cali, you know, could he take his place if it came down to it? Or could Schutte take his place if it came down to it? I think we'll still be seeing some remnants of the current administration, but, you know, what does that look like?
Aaron, I want to ask you a different question. I was sitting here, and I happened to notice that you're black.
Yeah.
And of course, that means you're an expert on everything having to do with African Americans.
Yeah, we're
and,
all related.
That's
yeah.
That shows the nature of deep thinking that we journalists have. But I'm going to say, I'm going to ask, seriously, Democrats have been very concerned because there was, understandably, huge turnout in places like Detroit among African Americans for President Obama both times. Now, there's not an African American on the ballot. Do you think there's going to be a significant fall off of black turnout, or is Trump going to get any votes among black people this year?
In Michigan, I don't think there will be any black turnout for Trump. I think there's definitely a bunch of Ben Carsons out there in the world. Shame on them. No, just kidding. I'm not going to belittle anybody for anyone's vote. There are black Republicans. I think they're a little more brazen this time around, but they were kind of in the closet like years past, but now, like, a tide has turned a little bit. But I think there is a sort of sentiment of begrudgingly voting for Hillary among a large segment of black voters, particularly younger black voters. Because of, now we were kids, I'm 32 just like you are, Zoe, just turned 32, and so many of people in my age group are just like, Hillary Clinton said back in 1994, the super predators, referring to the prosecution of drug dealers and so on and so forth. And sometimes I tell people, like, we were 10 years old. Do you really remember Hillary Clinton saying that? Like, were you watching C-SPAN or were you watching Disney Channel? You know? So I think a lot of people in that crucial millennial voting block have looked back to those comments and have retroactively applied them to this election, which I think is sort of a little bit unfair, because I think people's views can change over 20 years. People's policies can change over 20 years. But a lot of people will be having that in mind when they go to the polls. So I think there's not as much enthusiasm for Hillary as there was for
Obama. Will they be voting?
But will they be voting? Yes. But will they be going out and saying, yes, I did vote for Hillary? Probably not, because it's, like I said, it's a very begrudging choice for a lot of people.
Another question from the audience. Okay, let's see. There's a gentleman back there at the bar.
Hi. And my name's Leon Walker, and I'm the director of a local nonprofit.
Hi, Leon.
Hi. Okay, so I'm really frustrated with the election cycle. You know, we get towards the presidential election, and there's such focus on that national coverage, and especially this year with Trump and all the bombastic rhetoric. The local elections don't get much attention, in my opinion. And I'm specifically interested in Oakland County and Oakland County prosecutor. And I'm just curious, are we concerned that possibly unfit people are just going to pass? Our people aren't getting scrutinized enough because of that coverage at the national level. I mean, I have a lot of experience in Oakland County with the courts and with the government there. And I'm shocked there's not more attention given to that location.
Can you mention who the candidates are for prosecutor in Oakland County?
For prosecutor?
Yes.
Jessica Cooper, who is the incumbent, and Mike Getz.
Okay. That Jessica Cooper is a Democrat. Mike Getz is a Republican.
Yes. Although I happened to meet Mike Getz recently, and I would consider a nonpartisan Republican if there ever was one, I guess.
Okay. Well, how about our two party leaders responding to that? Stu?
I know Mike Getz pretty well. He works in the Attorney General's office. He's a career prosecutor. I think you kind of describe him right. He is nonpartisan in terms of how he approaches criminal justice. He's been a prosecutor his entire life. He's an extremely impressive guy. He's underfunded. I can't tell you the cash position of each of the candidates, where Cooper is, where Getz is, but I know Getz has struggled to raise money. And it's tough swimming upstream in Oakland County as a Republican down ballot. You know, I think Brooks Patterson will win comfortably. I think Mike Bouchard will win comfortably. I think some of the other races will have challenges. Mike Getz, anyone who would meet him and know him would be tremendously impressed by him. And you're right. There really hasn't been a lot of attention on that race. But Getz is a really good candidate, and I hope he's successful.
I think this goes back – oh, sorry, Brandon, you were going to
– No, I was just going to say, I mean, that's the challenge you have in a national election, where the focus on the media and, it's just the presidential. It sucks up all the oxygen out of the room, so it's incumbent on those local candidates to do whatever they can to try to get attention. But, you know, raging against the system as it is probably not going to do much, because these national elections are going to be national in focus.
And I was just going to say, I mean, I think it's shame on the media that right now you have newspapers and commercial television that's not where the focus is, because that's not what the ratings get, right? And I would more than love to have a staff at Michigan Radio of 30 people that were going through every day who candidates were and being able to put a ballot together. You've got very few media organizations like that, you know, NPR affiliates. You've got Bridge Magazine, which is doing an amazing job. But the fact is, there isn't many right now for that kind of journalism, that, you know, for profit, for-profit newspapers. That's not what folks are. Now, this room is very different, right? It is a Tuesday night, and you guys are at a bar with NPR talking about politics. I mean, you are a tiny, tiny, tiny segment of people right now. But if we had more folks who could fund that kind of journalism, believe you me, I would love it if 24 hours a day we were going through position papers and being able to go to these debates.
Part of the problem also is, even if we open the coffers for Zoe and, you know, all that money that NPR has stored up, not true.
We have it all in tote bags.
Oakland County is only a small part of the listening area, so that's another sort of decision. But Megan Casey, did you have a question? Did I see your hand up? Oh, I see. She was just twitching. Okay, this gentleman right here.
Hi, Rob Duchesne, retired Detroit public school teacher.
Hi, Rob.
Hi. My question, I don't want to put you on the spot, is really for Stu. Hypothetical, Hillary wins Tuesday. The Republicans retain the Senate. Can you see them stonewalling Hillary's nomination for Supreme Court justices for 4 years?
Traditionally, no. I mean, the tradition of the U.S. Senate is to give a good vetting process for the confirmation process. I know there was a news report today about candidate Richard Burr in North Carolina, U.S. Senator Richard Burr in North Carolina, who's not necessarily a bomb thrower or would be seen as sort of one of the real sort of far out there conservatives, saying that he can't see a process where anyone gets through. Now, I don't know the crowd he was talking to. I don't know the context of it, but I did hear that on the way over. My flat answer is I can see them basically confirming a nominee, but, you know, it is a hyper-partisan time.
Stu, do you think there's any chance, let's say Hillary Clinton wins and Democrats capture the Senate, might Merrick, the President Obama's nominee, be confirmed during the lame duck?
There's a school of Republicans that think that's their best play right now. I mean, the one thing for there's going to be a series of vacancies, and most likely in the next 4 years. And I think one of the reasons both sides are fighting so hard beyond getting their presidential candidates, the fact that they're probably going to shape the Supreme Court for the next three decades. That being said, I think there are a school of Republicans that believe they should confirm Garland. And if Clinton does win on Tuesday, I think that'll pick up steam.
Here's a measure of how things have changed, Breakfast Clubbers. In 1986, when Antonin Scalia, who was regarded as the Antichrist by liberals, when Antonin Scalia was up for confirmation, his confirmation was unanimous. Prior to that time, justices were not really judged in terms of ideology. They were occasionally rejected for segregationist backgrounds or financial improprieties. But now, you know, this is unprecedented in American history, the degree to which their ideology is scrutinized and which the court has become a partisan thing. Another question from someone who hasn't asked one.
Hey, Jack, this woman here in the khaki-colored jacket, I think her hand's been up.
Okay, well, how about the lady and then the man in front of him, man in front of her? I don't do pronouns well.
Hello, my name is Phyllis. I'm an IT analyst in Livonia and a lifelong Detroiter. My question is Proposal A. I've seen the commercials. I've heard the fear. I just want to
now, you
get
were
some
talking
facts.
About on the Detroit ballot.
On the Detroit ballot. I just want to get some facts on that because I don't know which way.
Before I let our panelists go, but first of all, there are two proposals on the Detroit ballot for so-called community benefits that having to do with construction projects. For example, the Gordie Howe International Bridge. One of them, it was put on by the city council, is much more moderate than Proposal A, which would require require companies building in Detroit to do a lot more in terms of community benefits, and would affect companies much smaller. So having started all that, Aaron, you're a Detroiter. You want to start that?
Sure. There's Prop A and Prop B. Very similar language, but there is a set with Prop A, both proposals call for more neighborhood community involvement in these large-scale projects like the GHB, the bridge, that unfortunate acronym there. But Proposal B has a $75 million threshold. So if, like, let's say the bridge or any other project in the city costs $75 million, then it wouldn't be the neighborhood or the community wouldn't give input. They would just serve as a quote-unquote advisory role, which would be what people on the community side and on the neighborhood side are pushing to, you know, vote yes on A, because then you'll have the input, then you'll have the chance for people that live in the neighborhood to not only have a say in the projects that go there, but also if they want to be considered for employment, whether it's building these bridges or building these things or things like that, they can make sure that they have a seat at that table. But if they're also pushing for a no vote on Prop B, because again, that, you know, that $75 million threshold, they will only be in an advisory role. So it's just like you can sit at the table and you can say something, but are they going to take you seriously when you do? So there is pushback on the development side because people are just saying, like, look, we just want to get this done. We just want to build this. It'll help everybody in the long run. Just trust us, you know.
And there's a fear that projects won't happen if they have to.
Right, because there's also a fear from the development side. It's just like, look, if you start bringing in, you know, all these people to have a say on it, and then it gets all complicated, and it'll create more red tape than we want to deal with, then they'll just say, look, we're just going to walk away and take our projects and take our money elsewhere. So that's where the debate is.
And if both of them pass, the one that gets the more votes takes effect, correct?
Exactly, yes.
Right. Do either of the parties have a position on this?
I don't believe so. The only thing I can say is, being someone in the Detroit viewing area, I think the opponents of Proposal A have done a really good job of framing the issue.
Okay.
Well, and what we know about ballots, too, and we know this very well, even though 2016 is the first time in years and years and years that we won't have a statewide ballot, is unless you have polling that shows that you have a yes, and this would be to enact something above 60% going in, it's a very solid idea that you are not going to pass it. And 60% is a high threshold when you consider that, you know, Michigan may go 52-48 in one direction or the other.
If I can drop in one more thing about Prop A, not to take a stance on it, but the thing that sort of surprised me about it is how it sort of galvanized the arts community in Detroit. I've seen there have been more creatives, you know, people working in museums, people who show things in galleries and so on and so forth. They have actually come out in force they are voting yes on A, no on B, because... As here in Detroit, as we talk about, you know, what role do the arts play, and so on and so forth, whether it's public art or street art and so on and so forth, a lot of people in that community believe that they are needed at the table and that they should be welcomed at that table and be part of those discussions. So that's something that I don't think we've talked about really at all, is like, you know, some of these subplots and subcommunities that suddenly are just like, oh, wait, this can help us too if we lobby for it. So that's been surprising to me.
I want to close by asking all of our panelists to respond to one issue we haven't talked about at all tonight. There's race for the State Board of Education. And it's being fought largely, especially the current president, John Austin, is running for re-election. He's a Democrat. The other Democrat is Ishmael Ahmed. Two Republicans are running against them. The main issue so far has been the question of transgender rights in schools, which is a very hot-button issue. And I'd like our panelists all to respond to what degree they think this will be the main factor and a game changer. Starting with Brandon, you.
Well, I you know, first of all, I support John Austin and Ish very strongly for many other issues besides that. I think it will send an important message, especially given the comments that Donald Trump has made about Muslim citizens, to send the first Muslim American to a statewide elected position in Michigan, I think would be a very good thing. But, you know, look, those races they fly under the radar, so to speak. So I don't think there's a lot. Most people won't, to this gentleman's question, won't take a lot of time to educate themselves on those issues. But I think both of them are going to win. And I do think John Austin has shown a lot of leadership in taking on an issue that other people in the past have been afraid to. And for people that say that this is a negative to take on this issue, look what's happened in North Carolina with the governor there in a reliably fairly conservative state, passed House Bill 2 or the anti-transgender bill, and he's going to lose re-election.
And they've lost a lot of convention business. Yeah. And yeah, Stu?
The Republican candidates are Tom McMillan and Nikki Snyder, and I support both of them. One of the issues, I think, I think one of the issues that the policy had to do with was actually parental information, and the fact that there were schools that were deliberately hiding information about the child from their parents. And I think that's what sort of tipped this issue off, got a bunch of parents up in arms and elected officials up in arms and sort of brought it here. But at the end of the day, these statewide board races are primarily dictated by who wins the top of the ticket. And in some respects, females perform a little better than males. But so I think, you know, depending on who wins this state, or is probably the party that's going to have their nominees win the state board of that.
That's what normally happens. I want to thank the people who really matter on behalf of all my fellow panelists, all of you who gave up your Tuesday night to come and hear five political wonks run their mouths, and especially because you've taken so much time to become informed about all these issues that are vital concern to all of us. I really admire you. I appreciate you paying attention to us, and I hope you have a great evening and that you vote early and often. Steve, now we should applaud you. Steve, did you want to say anything?
All right, thank you. Thank you once again all for coming out tonight. A big round of applause to the staff here at Hopcat for hosting us tonight. Tip your waitstaff well. And again, if you can join us next Tuesday, election night in Ann Arbor at Frazier's Pub. Watch the election night results roll in with us. Again, big round of applause for all of our panelists tonight. Thank you for coming.